Hello and welcome. It's your Managing Madrid podcast for this weekend. This is Gabe Lesra. It's August 5th, and I'm joined by Kian Sobhany. Hey, Kian.
Hello. How are you doing?
Doing well. And by Om Arvin. Om, thank you for writing this awesome immediate reaction to this Juve game. Real Madrid obviously beat Juventus 3-1 in a International Champions Cup, the prestigious International Champions Cup here in Washington, D.C.
Was this our first preseason win ever?
Well, I don't remember winning a preseason game last season, even.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we've won a preseason game, that's for sure.
And as we all know, it is really important and meaningful when the team wins a preseason game. One should take as much as possible from this.
Absolutely. There's so much to take away here. One, we're winning the treble. We're winning absolutely everything now that we've won this game.
Vinicius Jr. is better than Mbappe.
He's better than Ronaldo. Come on, guys. Let's be bold here. Bale is back. He's never going to get injured ever again. Lopetegui is already better than Zidane.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
It's just this is the greatest moment of our period right now. Beginning now, it's just going to be total and utter dominance.
But the real question is, where does Marcos Llorente stand in all this?
Oh yeah.
I'm sorry, Kian, but he's not part of it.
I'm glad that we
rage quitting this podcast.
You're rage quitting the podcast like Messi quit the national team after they lost that penalty kick.
That was uncalled for, Gabe. That was uncalled for. What did Messi do to you of late?
I just still think it's funny that exact moment. Like I watched that game and he just looked so bad, and then like they lost the penalty shootout, and it was so fucking funny. I'm going to just quit the national team in anger after losing the Copa America final to Chile on penalties. All right, well, everyone can tell that we're really not in full season form right now, but we're trying to get back. Madrid beat Juve, obviously, 3-1 goals from Carvajal and Propia, from Bale, and then two from Asensio, who I think of all the players really did seem to hit the ground running, Marco. So I don't know how much there is to take out of it. Obviously, what you look for in these games is like, how are the players combining with each other? Are they getting their match fitness? How is, like, Lopetegui does seem to come out and like try to implement a tactical idea each match, and sometimes multiple times a match. And so it was kind of interesting to watch Madrid's tactics, at least in the way that, the players are slowly and but surely understanding the juego de posición stuff that Lopetegui is trying to do.
This was go ahead, Om.
I was just going to talk about, like, the pressing was the most positive thing that we saw there in terms of tactics, because in the first game, right, it took like 15 to 20 minutes to really get into the high-pressing game that Lopetegui wants, which is understandable. We didn't look very fit. It was nice to see that this game, straight off the bat, it was high-pressing. We already looked way fitter than we did the last game, which was really nice to see. And it wasn't just the fitness. It was really organized, unusually organized for a preseason game. And I don't want to take away too much from Juventus's performance, but it is worth noting that they looked extremely uncomfortable. I think our pressing was at a level not usually expected at preseason, because I think in a normal game, Juve deals with that a lot better, but they just looked terrible whenever we were pressing them, because it was really compact. The front three with the two central midfielders were moving in unison, and then the fullbacks would bomb up whenever the ball moved wide. It was very nice to see. It didn't last into the second half that well, which is expected. Again, it's preseason, but you could see the fitness, you could see the mentality that's needed for pressing. Everyone was really aggressive. Everyone was moving in unison. So that was very promising to see, and it shouldn't be that surprising, because under Zidane, we did have good moments of pressing, so it's obvious that this team understands like the triggers, how to move in unison, all of that kind of good stuff. It's about applying the fundamental concepts on a consistent basis now, so it happens every game, and we don't have these erratic performances. And I think that will be emphasized under Lopetegui because it's needed under positional play, this rigorous application of concepts for this entire system to work. So
yeah,
I expect to see this game, you know, every single game now, because that's the way he wants to play.
Well, there's an urgency with it, like a preseason or not, because Lopetegui has to come in and kind of implement his ideas before the season starts, so that once the season starts, you're hitting your stride. And I know, like with preseason, we only take so much away, and as we've noted before, we win a preseason game every 10 years, and it doesn't matter because we win the Champions League. But I think to gradually ingrain these things into the habits of the collective habit, but also the individual habit of the players to press the way they did and be in the positions they're supposed to be, so that it comes second nature for them, there's an urgency to do that now and try to ingrain it in the team. I thought, so the first half, we did a lot to even make Chesney uncomfortable. And there wasn't much offensive curation in the first half. And apart from, you know, Bale would get it, he would release it and immediately dart to a run, and either Kroos or Isco would try to hit him. And Kroos actually did hit him a couple times with a couple of really nice passes. Or it was just the press winning possessions. And I remember on one instance, Ceballos winning the ball and then getting fouled, which would have led to a breakaway. And it was Benatia, by the way, who was still, has a ton of rage in his heart for us. I think the second half, the press was actually quite impressive as well. Cause you had a bunch of, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't right off the bat, but like towards that stretch where we were having like 8 million counterattacks against Juve, and it started to look like a carbon copy of the Champions League final 2017. there was Asensio, Vinicius, Odegaard, Ceballos was another one. We're pressing really well, and I think that something happened in the background in my house. I don't know what it was, but that in itself was like really impressive to me too. Like there was something there that I think everyone was on the same page about, and which was exciting.
And I think the way Lopetegui is going about implementing his tactical ideas is the right way, because if you look at our pressing as the strongest, what wasn't very strong was our passing. There were three or four moments where it did look quite good, where, you know, we'd attract the attention of the defense, we'd attract the press on one side, you know, we'd try to probe. It wouldn't work. We'd circulate the ball backwards, and then we quickly switch play, and we have an outlet there, and we do that, and you know, a couple of times in that preseason game, even the one before, and we'd work our way quickly into the box, and we'd create a dangerous attack. Like, that is classic positional play, but it wasn't happening regularly, and most of the time, you know, our structure looked slightly off. Like, our players weren't getting into their correct positions fast enough. You know, the speed of thought, you know, was just half a second too slow. And just in general, the overall chemistry when we were trying to build from the back was just a bit off. And that's not that worrying to me. This is a difficult system that takes a while most of the time to get your players to understand. But to me, this is even less worrying, because what's always most important in when you're implementing a tactical system is to get the defensive side of the game first, because that is always the most important, especially when you have the offensive quality we do. It's nice to see that our pressing is there. So if we can get our defensive stuff figured out before the season begins, we can rely on individual quality to carry us for a bit before we get our offensive system in place. And so that way we're not leaking goals, and we can, you know, we can edge out these wins, you know, 1-0, 2-1, maybe 2-0, because we have that individual quality, you know, rather than the opposite of us having our offensive system in place and these really shaky, like 3-2, 4-3 wins, maybe even a loss where we can see it a lot. So I'm pretty happy with the place we're in right now when it comes to our tactics. I think it's going along quite well, slowly in some places, but I think we're emphasizing the right pieces right now.
And Lopetegui did show some new offensive looks. I mean, I think for the first time saw him with Real Madrid at least roll out that false nine when in the second half, when Asensio basically played there, and I thought that looked really good too. I mean, his That Asensio Vinicius combination leading up to the second goal, or for the second goal, was very brilliant, I thought. And Vinicius himself, like, seems to be adapting faster and with more poise than I expected, to be honest. And it was a cool system watching Asensio play in that center. Like, we had been talking previously about how that was, first of all, that's one of the looks that Lopetegui likes to go with, and second of all, that Madrid actually does have a team that's really set to do something like that. And it was cool to watch that kind of be executed on the pitch.
The Asensio false nine is, I think if we don't bring anyone in, like, buckle up, I think that's going to be something we'll see a lot of, because that's essentially our second option, if not first option in many games. You can't rely on Benzema every single game to do this. And look, I personally think Asensio is built to play that role. I think he can do it. I think one of the reasons why, if there's no urgency, be it right or wrong, and whether we agree or not, is because to sign a striker is because Asensio, in Lopetegui's eyes, can play that role. And it's could be a combination of not necessarily not wanting a striker, but also, like, the ones you can get maybe don't provide that big of an upgrade in Lopetegui's eyes for the money you would spend on them and whatever. But I think that him playing that second half was just kind of, I don't know if it's a premonition, but it's something that I think he wants to try to see more of and figure it out how it's going to work, because I think as the transfer window draws to a close, slowly but surely, I don't if the striker doesn't come in, we're going to see a lot of it.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think it's a good option. Like, I personally, I would really consider him just being the starting false nine. I would. Over Benzema, even.
It's an interesting option to have. I need to see more of Asensio playing there in competitive games to really get a sense of whether I like it or not, mainly because there's not a lot of false nines that exist in world football and have existed. So it's very difficult to, I think, like, you can see a player and look at his qualities and be like, well, he'd be great on the left wing. But I think it's very hard for the false nine because it's sort of an ambiguous position. A lot of qualities you could kind of slot in there. There are players you think who could play there who couldn't. So
we also have, I think, a grand total of 2-game sample size of Asensio playing as a false nine. So
yeah, right. So I think there is promise. I think, like, as much as you can tell, like, what makes a false nine good, I think Asensio has some raw qualities. But I would urge people to be, I think, cautiously optimistic is fair, which I don't think you, Keon and Gabe are being overly optimistic. I think you both know how to ground your expectations. I'm just speaking to the larger audience here, because it is difficult. If you think about the great false nines, like, there's Messi, and then there's Francesco Totti, and there's not that many more. And it's hard to balance the act of being this extra link in midfield and still scoring a ton of goals because you still are the number nine.
Yeah.
So it will be interesting to see how Lopetegui makes that work. Fingers crossed. I mean, I think Asensio has some raw skills to make it happen, but we'll see how it plays out.
We've also seen Isco play in that role. I mean, I think that it's more that I'm excited about the idea, because I think this squad is actually kind of set up to do well with a false nine generally, not necessarily who it is exactly. Because we know that Isco can play the false nine. It appears that Asensio can play this position pretty well. And Benzema basically already sort of plays like a false nine. So, like, it's just good to see that he is running this formation and this tactical idea out, which is something that, you know, I think that for all the brilliance of Zidane, he didn't have that ability to experiment and have new tactical ideas. When, you know, he definitely did have different looks that he played, but this is one look that I wanted to see more of that we hadn't, and we'd been clamoring for such a long time. And it's good that I think that Lopetegui is trying it out and that it's giving pretty good results. I mean, obviously Isco isn't at his peak or even close to it. He looks quite gassed. I mean, he basically played the best of anyone on that Spain team for the most minutes, and, you know, I can totally get being gassed, like going and having that type of World Cup where you are basically trying to carry that team by yourself, and then just going on vacation and not really doing as much physical training, so that when you get back, the first few games, of course, are going to be exhausting. But I think when he's back to kicking at full stride, he will be a great option for as that kind of binding agent there, and playing at that false nine occasionally. Not just Asensio, basically.
Well, I think the two traits that Asensio has that I think will make him a good candidate in this role more than other people in the squad is that, one, he can finish. He's a good finisher. He can score goals. You put him in enough chances and he's going to, I think, significantly upgrade his goal tally from last season in a more prominent role. And two, to me, the false nine just needs to be really intelligent off the ball in his movement. And the limited sample size we had last season of both him and Isco in a free role, Asensio to me looked like he was more efficient, just knowing where to be. I would also say that I don't know if we can talk about this enough. To me, it's a bit under-talked about. This entire season, to me, rests on Bale's health. Like, if he's not healthy for the significant, more important stretch of the season, I don't know what else to say. Like, I think it really is on his shoulders. Because if he's part of the reason why it's hard to bring in someone like Hazard, because we can talk about Asensio's playing time, but someone like Hazard would help a lot if Bale gets injured for a big stretch of the season. But if Bale stays healthy, I think it changes everything, because he is de facto like the only reliable game in, game out goal scorer we have in the entire squad. That's him.
Yeah.
And if anything happens to him, I'd start sweating.
And he really is that game breaking, game changing talent with just the ability to strike the ball, his nose for goal, his physicality. I mean, he is, when he is healthy, the, you know, definitely for me a top five player in the world. And it's going to be important, because those are the types of players that you need to lean on when things aren't really working out, or you know, the tactical ideas aren't coming off as well. You know, you need those players like Bale to step up and put the team on their back, and we'll have to see if he's going to be able to do that. I think he will, but it really is just going to come down, like you said, to health. And even in this game, we saw him. I mean, that was an incredible strike. It's preseason, who cares? But my, oh my, was that a good shot?
It was a great shot. The thing with Bale in the preseason to me has been that he's kind of looked like in fifth gear. Like, I think that was part of the reason why the second half to me was more exciting. And by the way, like, the game against Juve reminded me why I don't find preseason that interesting. The first game I found really more fascinating because I think I was just deprived of Real Madrid. And then you're like, oh, it's preseason, it's really not that exciting. Maybe it actually just really wasn't exciting and the first game was better. But
that's what I think.
Yeah, the second half of... but that was one of the reasons the second half was better, because the kids were hungry and they were in... I think Vinicius and like these guys, at least in terms of effort levels, if not form, were in first gear. Whereas Bale was just kind of feeling it out to me, a bit casual, and understandably so. Like, he's just trying to go through the motions at this point of the season. But like, you know, we'll talk about him at some point. But I think when you look at the gear that the kids were in, because they had something to prove, I thought that's the stuff that makes preseason really exciting. Bale looks fine. I don't think he's been great or bad. He's just kind of there doing, just trying to get into some kind of rhythm.
I don't know if you want to.
I kind of ended that statement on like half. I just kind of ended it without really finishing a sentence. So I left you guys in limbo. So I just leave it up to you guys to take over and pick up.
These preseason podcasts, you know, we really are just trying to get up to speed. You can't ask too much of us. We're just trying to try new tactical ideas. And
we're in fifth gear. Every now and then, Ohm takes a shot outside the box. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And then he gets rested for the second half of the podcast. Where are you, Ohm?
I'm here.
The guy with the most notes from this game. We need you to carry us. Tell us more about your immediate reaction.
A moment. Okay, I mean, if you don't have anything much more to say about this game, we can go and, I mean, again, this, let's be clear, this is preseason, so it's not like we're, we either of us, Kian, took tons of notes or any notes in my case, but
you know, I mean, I think we can point out, I was just trying to like quickly run through like what I think we can mention. I think Reguilon is how you say his name. I think he played quite well from left back. Castilla player. Yeah, second game in a row where he looked quite impressive again. I don't know how much to take away from it, but it was impressive to see the confidence he came out with. You know, I hardly saw any mistakes from him. He had a really nice moment where he cut inside on his weaker foot and launched a shot at goal.
Yeah.
And forced Chesney into a good save. You know, that was nice to see. I mean, I think this is just, I think all the youngsters have shown us at least something, except for what was the name of the center back that's played now twice in a row?
Javi Sanchez.
Yeah, I mean, he's looked a little out of his depth.
He looked a bit better last game. Like I thought, you know.
Yeah, it could just be nerves. And again, like it's hard. Like I don't want to go out straight up and say this guy can't play for Real Madrid, but you know, from what we've seen, he struggled a little bit. But otherwise, I think all the other youngsters have looked quite confident. You know, they've shown something that I'm sure, you know, Lopetegui is noting down, and even more so probably what they show in training. Yeah. You know, and I hope this helps them, you know, gain some confidence before they go out on a loan or something.
Speaking of these young ones, I actually wanted to bring one piece of news up that I realized we didn't talk about last time, Kian, which is that Lopetegui has named Albert Celades as the second coach, and Celades was the coach of the under 21 Spanish team, which means that he actually has a good relationship with a lot of these people already. And my understanding is that he is quite a well-liked coach in the Spanish kind of universe.
Yeah, I think, and I still to this day am a bit surprised that Spain didn't bring in Celades instead of Hierro during that whole fiasco when they let Lopetegui go last second. Because he has a clear, at least, coaching philosophy and identity, whereas Hierro just kind of went into it raw and was just there as a kind of a figure more than a coach, if you ask me. Which was kind of unfair to Hierro too, in the sense, you know, there's only so much he can do in that situation. I thought Celades would have been a more logical choice. I didn't expect him to come in as a second choice here, but I think, as stylistically, he fits. He does understand the juego de posición, how it works. He has a connection with the younger players. He was the coach of the under 21 team with Mayoral, Llorente, Odriozola. There, Ceballos is another one. Asensio was also in that team. I think he's actually quite a qualified assistant coach, to be honest. This is kind of cool to have him around. If you remember him as a player, quite an unremarkable player. He was he was one of the few in the short list of the history of football that played for Barcelona and Real Madrid. And when we signed him from Barca, it was just kind of like no one cared. Like it was like, okay. And he played a few games, like as a coach, he's been a bit better. And I think it's cool to kind of bring him in. There's certainly nothing, I don't see any harm in it. He's a good connection with the younger players. Yeah.
Well, that's
not what you were saying.
If anything, I think it's nice. Like, I think it's a great addition, personally, because he and Lopetegui have a good relationship. Very clearly, they both have a very similar and very clear style. They both understand and implement the juego de posición very well. And Celades especially have a very good relationship with this kind of young core of Spanish players. And I think that if Madrid is going to do well this season, it really will come down a lot, in addition to like just Gareth Bale's body. It's going to come down to how well this core of Spanish kids evolve, because they really did invest a huge amount of the future of the team and just in these players, in this group of players being good and as good as everyone has said they are. And it's time for them to step up and, you know, this is their season, and this is two coaches who are literally, this is what they are brought in for, is to make this this group of players kind of realize their potential.
Yeah, I have I have a couple more notes from this game if you want.
Do it.
We did a little rapid fire at the last podcast with any leftover notes I had from these preseason games. There's not many that we didn't already talk about, that, but I will just say two things. Javi Sanchez, which I briefly mentioned, I thought he had a better game. He had like one really shocking giveaway in the second half where Juve had a dangerous counterattack. But all in all, I think because he was on the same side as Carvajal, in the first half in particular, he actually covered for Carvajal quite a bit and had successfully came over to that flank when Carvajal was caught out and dispossessed the ball carrier. Whereas the first game, he was really, it must have been confidence because he had a good season with Castilla. And Castilla is like one exciting thing about them just generally under Solari has been their defense has been actually good. And Javi Sanchez looked out of it just in the first game, not in sync with the rest of the defensive line, like not offside traps and just giveaways, defending set pieces. He was better. But this leads to Carvajal, who is still like this. This goes back to our 1 year anniversary this time last preseason where he just was not Carvajal anymore. He stepped it up a few times in the Champions League, I think. And even his presence out of form is still the best option at right back we have, if you ask me, because he brings a lot to the table. He just, I don't know what it is with him, but he doesn't look confident. His touch is a bit off. Let's hope that none of this matters and that Odriozola might light a fire in him to pick
that's
it up.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
That's definitely the hope.
Yeah.
I wanted to also mention that Valverde played, Fede played 90 minutes, which is cool.
Yeah.
I think he is a really exciting, you know, long-term player for Madrid. And I'm interested to see how you guys see this going for him, because obviously his last loan spell really didn't work very well.
No.
He did not play very much, and I'm not sure how much he's developed. So Madrid really need to figure out a better way to help him develop a little bit more. And if that's finding a better team to loan him to, then fine. Or if that's bringing him back to Castilla and like giving him more minutes, that's fine too. I mean, I'm interested in how the next step for him is. You think?
Well, he can't play in the team this season. It's just that there's too many players in his position. He has to go on loan. He has to go somewhere. I'm not opposed to an option where you go a 1 year loan with where the team has an option to renew his loan for a second year, because I don't think it's that urgent to bring him in given Kovacic and Ceballos are still here. I would say that I think he looked good in this game against Juve, and I thought like some of the way he read some of the passing lanes has actually worked as a box-to-box midfielder. He can play that role. I think maybe this performance against United was a bit overblown. I didn't think he looked that good, especially in the first half. Second half, he looked better, but I think that was just understandable because he's just getting back into it. He's rusty. His loan spell, he didn't play. Seydorf came in, tried to play him, and then he got injured, which was a disaster. I think he needs and will go on loan this summer or this season. I don't know where, but I'm assuming somewhere in La Liga where he can play, because there's just not at this moment. There's too many players in this position.
Yeah, but he is still quite young and has that potential. I also thought Odegaard once again looked pretty good.
Yeah. I think so too. Odegaard just to me like just fits. He looks confident. Yeah,
he's
showing for the ball constantly.
He almost is ready. I think he. I definitely think he deserves one more a year on loan in Spain. But he really does look ready, and like he belongs. You know.
Yeah, I don't think if you bring him off the bench in a game in La Liga this season, to me, I don't think he'd look out of place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I mean. So, I mean, yeah, obviously he's going to go out again, but I definitely think it's time for him to make the next step up from Heerenveen, which is a good team, obviously, but, you know, playing in the high level in Spain is the next step for him, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's where he's going to end up. I'd be really curious to know where he ends up, and for sure, wherever he goes, we're going to pencil that game in the calendar to watch it.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. That's still true with a lot of these players. So, I think that's basically hits all of the notes that I wanted to hit in this just talking about this game. I don't know if you guys want, but we have a lot of questions, and I figure we just jump into those now.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Jason Morel asks us, everyone is saying that Odriozola is a long-term successor to Carvajal, but I believe he's here to push him right now and fight for his spot immediately. Carvajal is just 26 years old and probably is another 4 to 6 years at a high level. I really doubt Odriozola would want to sit behind him that long with no chance of supplanting him. Odriozola was better than Carvajal last season, and with Danny's injury history, I believe we'll see Odriozola sooner rather than later. Am I wrong to believe this?
No. I mean, I think that's pretty much spot on. Like, I think the reason we got Odriozola was because we've realized that Carvajal doesn't play very well when he doesn't have competition. I mean, the two seasons where he has not been particularly outstanding were 2014-15 and then the last season, 2017-18, when he pretty much had no competition. 14-15, it was an Arbeloa that was way past his prime. And 17-18, there was literally no right back behind him. It was makeshift with Nacho. And you had Ashraf, who, I mean, he's extremely raw. I mean, very talented, obviously, but nowhere near the level to compete with someone of Carvajal's caliber. So Odriozola has come in, you know, he is a quality first team player. He is close to the world class level for a fullback. So I mean, he's coming here to fight for that place, yeah, and light a fire under Carvajal. The club was not going to sign or play another right back that simply never had a chance of fighting for Carvajal's place, because that is neither good for it's neither good for the club nor for the player Carvajal.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this comment, this question is pretty much spot on.
What would you say is Carvajal's best season ever?
Best season, 16-17.
Yeah, and that was following one of his worst seasons ever, 15-16.
Yeah.
I thought 15-16 was actually pretty good. 14-15 was the one
bad.
That was
really bad.
Yeah. Which one was the one that he wasn't great against Juve for two legs? That was
15-16.
2014-15. Right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, because 2015-16, Danilo came in and everyone thought Danilo was going to replace him. And Carvajal even admitted later that he thought this was the end for him. So he like worked his ass off and played like it was his last game every single time. And we were like, wow, this is incredible, because Danilo completely, I mean, he was a disappointment, and Carvajal just completely turned his career around again. And so that was, and then it was disappointing in 2017-18 to see him dip again. But I think we've identified a pattern now of why that happened.
Yeah. Well, that was my ultimate point, is that can Odriozola be the Danilo that lights a fire, but also be better than Danilo himself? Like, that's where I see this signing as not only successful because Odriozola is good, but also because maybe this is what Carvajal needs. I'm also not sure if he's 100% healthy yet either. That's the thing. Like, I think he's playing through something.
Yeah, I do too. I'm just not sure. I don't know. I really like Odriozola though. So right now Madrid has got two very high level young right backs that are going to be, that both play really well. Carvajal, like, I think, has a slight edge in both attacking and defending, but that is subject to change easily. So, all right. Ian Marley asks us, of all the strikers linked to Real Madrid, one who has not been mentioned is Aguero. What do you guys think of him, and would he fit the system? I really like him, and I think he'd be an excellent fit for Lopetegui's system.
I honestly, like, I don't think Aguero is, well, not this season anyways, his name certainly didn't come up. And I think the reason is, I think he's actually still playing at high level. Like, there was definitely a period of time where Guardiola was just obsessed with Gabriel Jesus, and then Aguero didn't play. But when he came in and he started to actually play well. But the problem is, I guess he's 30, and he himself has said that he is just going to see out the end of his contract with City. And I believe it goes to 2020, I think, is at least.
I don't know if there's
anything else to say about this.
Yeah, I don't think he's on the market. I just don't think he wants to go. I think Guardiola wants to let him. So,
I mean, Aguero was arguably the best striker in the world last season, if you're not counting Ronaldo and Messi as strikers. I mean, so, yeah, I have no idea why City would let him go. His age, is not something that would be great for the long term. And, you know, there's injury concerns. So let's say he becomes available two seasons from now, it would probably only be because his form has fallen off. You know, Gabriel Jesus has managed to replace him, and, you know, or he has some kind of injury. And I think at that point, Aguero wouldn't look like such an appealing option. There was a point in time several seasons back where I badly, badly wanted Aguero, and it kind of looked like it was possible. I think I might be wrong. This is a long time ago, but I think even Aguero kind of talked about coming to Madrid and had me really excited. You know, I would definitely have taken him then. I think it was after Higuain left, and we only had Benzema as our striker, and Aguero would have been amazing at the time. But now it's just too late, and, you know, I don't think there's any way City or Pep Guardiola is going to let this guy go, because he transformed himself last season into a truly all-round forward who could do absolutely everything. And so that was surprising for me to see the way he was able to transform himself so late in his career. But, you know, this guy is impressive, and he's not going anywhere anytime soon as long as he's still in his prime.
Chris G asks us, I live in the D.C., Maryland area. It was pretty cool to see Real Madrid live. But my question for you guys is, do you believe there's any chance Chelsea are doing what United did in 2015 with De Gea and dragging out the transfer of Courtois until the last second? Yeah, maybe, right? Like, that De Gea thing didn't work because Real Madrid had the fax machine issue, but if all the technology had worked, Madrid would have gotten De Gea anyways. So in the end of the day, like, if that's what they're doing, fine. But every indication we've seen in every media, including today or yesterday with his agent literally saying you are keeping a man from staying with his family in the media. I mean, it's hard for you to come back from having your agent say to your club, let this man be with his family. You know, every indication we're seeing is that he is pushing to go in a way that we haven't seen many people push to go in a while. So I still think this is a transfer that's quite likely.
Well, I think their saving grace might be that Sarri just really wants to keep him. Everything that Sarri said publicly is that, like, we really value Courtois. It would not be good to lose him. I don't know what happens. I agree that it's likely. But I also just have no idea. And the whole parallel with 2015, I think probably only comes into play because they're both goalkeepers. And I think the De Gea thing, like, we can talk about the last second fax machine and all that. I think it's also possible that both clubs were kind of just waiting until the end to see if there was a bit of, like, there was a sense of cold feet heading into it that, you know, maybe this is a good idea, maybe this is not, maybe this is the best price we can pay or get for him, maybe it's not. I don't know if Courtois is necessarily in that situation, but I think we all agree that Courtois at that price would actually be an interesting get. Maybe if you're not paying, like, you know, tons and tons of money for him, but at the price that Real Madrid can get him, I think it's an interesting choice, even despite Courtois not having his best year. It'd be interesting to see how the saga goes on, but it's possible that I think Sarri can still twist his arm. It's just one of those things that you just don't know. It's possible that it'll drag, though. I don't know.
All right, this seems like a good time to mention this, but when the show starts ramping up during the year, we like you said, if you toss us $5 a month, we'll answer your question and each show. But the way that works is that we're going to answer one question per person on the show. So we guarantee that we'll answer one of your questions. And if you want to ask like three or four, just tell us, you know, and you care a lot about which one gets answered, make sure you mention that in the question itself. So because generally these we can end up with 5, 6, 7 pages of questions. So we need to figure out, we do a little bit of culling. We promise that we're going to answer a question from each of you per pod. It's just that sometimes we get people who ask like 7, 6, 7 questions. And while we love that, we can't just give 20 minutes of a show because you ask 6, 7 questions. We try to answer your question, and we do reserve the right to do a little bit of chopping and editing to make sure that we give you the best possible answer. to the most interesting question. So just saying that now, because I'm about to say Sajid Reyes has a few questions for us. So I guess we're going to try to go through these. We're going to go through them pretty quickly. If you were Florentino Perez and you heard firsthand the ludicrous offer that Inter have supposedly made for Modric, which is apparently a 15 million euro loan for this season and a 25 million euro option to purchase in 2019, how would you react? If the objective is to reject the offer and humiliate them at the same time, I would do what Florentino Perez did, actually. I would just say his clause is 750 million and then not answer any more questions.
Yeah, I would not even entertain it further, because I think to entertain it further would be to entertain it as something serious, as something that you see as a threat. I would just shrug it off. I think that's the most humiliating way you could treat it. Not that I think Florentino is trying to be humiliating, but I think that could have the best effect that Sajid is going for, while keeping it classy and while, you know, just not entertaining it as something serious. Because to brush off an offer from a club like it doesn't exist, you know, that can be pretty insulting, especially because Inter Milan still, you know, they're still a pretty big club historically. They've had their moments in Italy. They're, you know, they've been a serious force of late. So I, like Gabe said, that's just the best way to deal with it.
Yeah. The second one is, ever since the Ronaldo transfer, why are the Italians and the Italian media behaving like a bunch of fools who just come out of prison after 20 years and haven't got laid? especially with the Modric stories. I mean, I don't really know what this is. I think there is just a general feeling in Italy that they want their teams to get back to being considered among the elite in Europe, and it's been a long time since any team other than Juve has really, I think, been counted among the elite. And I think especially the Milan clubs are both feeling like they've come a long way since their glory days and want to get back up. Especially, I mean, like AC Milan is clearly out to change things up a little bit. I mean, they just did some really great business with Higuain and Caldera, and I think they are in a better financial position now after the sale from their truly shady owner guy. And then Inter is basically the same thing. I mean, they fended off obviously a bid from Madrid for what's his name, the striker, and now they're trying to again also be one of the teams that kind of fights back into the top end of the spectrum. And then like Napoli brought in Ancelotti, which is a crazy and amazing play, I think. So I think the Italian teams are trying their best to get back, and that's why we're hearing so much about them, because this is really, they feel like they've been out of the game for such a long time. What are you doing? Is that home?
No.
I don't know. I don't know what home is doing. But I also don't necessarily know or understand the context of what this question is about. It seems some of the wording is a bit aggressive.
Bro, I was laughing so fucking hard throughout the thing. I'll fucking tell you, the way this question was phrased, man.
Do I have to do editing now, man?
I'm sorry, go on, Kio, go on.
I thought Omen was having a seizure for a second. I hate editing. Damn it.
I just say keep it in, man. Oh, whatever.
Keep the shit in, man. Keep it in.
As I was saying, I thought the wording was a bit harsh and aggressive. I would say that I think, you know, if it's just speaking to Adam Digby, friend of the show who's been on Juve Journalist, this is a big deal for Juve getting Ronaldo. Like, it was a huge deal. Forget that it's Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the greatest player of all time, arguably the greatest player of all time. You know, as he said, Juve have never, ever signed the best player in the world in a transfer window. So this was a huge deal for not only them, but also Italian football. So I don't know entirely the context of the question, you know, the wording of the question, who is kind of being a quote-unquote fool or idiot or whatever, because they're excited about these signings. But, you know, it's a huge deal for them to be quote-unquote back on top, or at least to a level where they're attracting players of this magnitude.
Yeah. Our last one from Sajid is, what the fuck is happening with PSG and FFP? Sajid, I hope you're all right, man. This is PSG. Remember that. I mean, I have an article actually coming out about this, but PSG, they have a lot of, their owners are really, really rich. Remember that. So there are ways to play games with FFP. We'll see how that's exactly gone. But, FFP wasn't designed to prevent clubs from spending money if they have money. It was designed to make sure that clubs don't spend money they don't have, if that makes sense. So PSG has a lot of money and they're throwing it around. And, you know, they threw a lot of it around last year. They're throwing a lot of it around this year. And I don't know. We'll have to see whether that even works out for them. It didn't work out for them last year, really. And I mean, if they go and get Kante and Boateng and whatnot, they will have a really, really good team.
The Boateng thing is entirely bizarre, by the way, because it's about his ties with Jay-Z, because he's one of the footballers who signed with Jay-Z's sports agency. Really? Yeah. And so Rummenigge and the entire Bayern front office are just absolutely fed up with Boateng's like regular trips to New York to see Jay-Z and hang out with him. And they feel like he's been distracted. So it's a very bizarre situation. I'm sure PSG won't care about any of that stuff. They just want to sign him. I mean, if I were Bayern, I don't know if it's an overreaction, but Boateng is, to me, still one of the best defenders in the world. So it seems kind of weird to use this as a reason to offload him.
It does feel a little bit like Bayern is staying put when maybe they should be playing a little bit more aggressive defense. But
yeah, I don't want to get too much into this, but after the kind of like Ozil comments and stuff, this guy has his own idea of what a moral code should be. I'm talking about Rummenigge here, not Boateng. He sees this in his own way. So I don't necessarily see how this is particularly a problem, since I think Boateng has been a class center back, you know, on the pitch for several seasons now. But, you know, I think there's more going on here than just simple, like, you know, this is affecting his performances on the pitch.
Yeah, I agree.
Necessarily think it is, but that is a different topic entirely.
Yeah. All right. Carlos Salinas asked, I really like Leonin, the little we've seen of him. How often do you think he'll play with the first team? More than Casilla?
It all depends on what happens in the transfer window. Does Courtois come? Does he not? If this is the roster and this is what we're going into the season like today, this and there was no other additions, I'd prefer Leonin to get over Casilla as a second choice.
I mean, I think so, but I think what's going to happen is that Leonin is going to. I think Casilla is going to be the backup, and I'm not wrong. Leonin is the one who's going to be the Casilla number one, right?
I don't know if there's any definitive thing either way.
I am of the belief that Courtois will come in and Navas will kind of battle for the first place, and then, you know, do some rotation between those two. If that signing happens, then Leonin will go on loan, I think, and Casilla probably has his days numbered with Real Madrid, which is fine by me. I don't have any personal animosity toward Casilla. I just don't think he's good enough to play for this team.
I mean, he's average. I mean, nothing wrong with that, but he's average. That's just how it is.
Yeah. But if Courtois doesn't come, I think it could very well we'll just have the same goalkeeper situation as last year, where Casilla is playing second and Kaylor is starting, and that's sort of where we are.
I think that's exactly what it's going to be.
I think not that I knew anything about Leonin before we signed him, but now that I know him, I think he's overqualified for Casilla, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, he might go on loan still.
Probably.
Essa Hariri says, I have a question for you guys. How can a player be so professional that he can silence his emotions and support a club he loved since he was a kid and join the rival club and give his best there? For example, Modric was a Barca fan but ended up in Real Madrid and gave his best there. Other examples include Coutinho, Isco, and believe it or not, Iniesta. I think it's because you're a professional and you just, you know, well, this is your job. You do your job.
Yeah. So. I think that, weirdly enough, like, I've thought about this a lot, even though I absolutely have never had a fucking chance to, you know, even a little chance in, like, 0.001% to ever become a professional football player. But, like, I thought about, you know, that's, like, that's been, I'm sure that's every single one of us here have dreamed of that at some point, especially when you were in high school, you know, just out of nowhere, a scout comes and says, you know what, you want to play for my club? And, you know, I've thought about this extensively. What if Barcelona came and said the same to me? Would I say yes? What is my duty as a fan? Yeah, I'm not sure I've answered that definitively, but I've tried to put myself in the shoes of other players. And when you become a professional football player, the first thing you have to understand is that you're no longer a fan and that you have to take care of yourself. This is as fans, we forget that this is a game of slim margins and that a lot of the chances these players get is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's never going to come again. If Barcelona comes to you and says, we want you to come play for the academy, you cannot turn that down because you cannot bet that Real Madrid is going to come, you know, a week later and say, hey, you want to join us? Like, this is your one chance and you have to take it. And I mean, that's what you, because it will, playing for Barcelona, you know, will help your professional career, whether you're playing with the academy or whether you're playing with your first team. It's not something that's going to come again. So you have to say yes. And again, I think as fans, that's sometimes difficult to understand, but once you put yourself in the mindset of a professional, it becomes a fairly easy decision because you got to play for yourself. You got to enhance your own career. If you want to become a great, you got to make decisions like these. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's very tough for people like, you know, Isco, Coutinho, Modric, because they know what they're here for. And it's for them to be the best professional they can be. And that means signing for the best teams that are available out there.
Think also about...
I would fucking do it, absolutely. For whatever reason. I know, wow. Like, whatever. 100%. Are you kidding? Like, if they're, like, the only people offering you a chance to, like,
of course,
follow your dream and be a footballer, and yeah, so what? You just put it aside and go, you know, shoot your shot, you know what I'm saying? Like,
think about also what some of these players go through as kids.
Absolutely.
Like, Modric is the guy who literally they were finding shelter in abandoned buildings and hearing grenades go off outside. So when you come from especially from a childhood like that, I don't care who's paying you. Like, it's you take it. You sort out your entire family. Like, that's it. This is also why I kind of find it hard that people criticize so much when these players like Paulinho or whoever just go to China and get a bunch of money. Like, you have no idea what a lot of these players go through as kids. And if you think that playing for your rival, you know, it's a no-brainer to me, you know?
That's a really good point, because the way I was coming at it was like, it was from a privileged position, the way I was tackling the problem. I don't know if I say most, but a ton of these players, like you said, like when you wrote that article about Casemiro, they come from utter poverty.
Yeah.
And so they don't even have the luxury of thinking about it the way I was saying I would think about it, you know, where your club loyalties lie. This is my one chance and my dream to put food on the table every single day, you know, and make sure my parents live comfortably for the rest of their lives. And when you put it that way, like, I think the way you said it, Keon, was perfect, because when you put it that way, like, it is no debate. Like, there's no question. You just take it immediately. I don't think there's more to say after that, because I think that was the perfect way to say it.
Last question. Thomas Berg asked us, not last question, there are more.
it's like the third or fourth last question. on the page you're reading.
Yeah, last question on the page I'm reading. Thomas Berg asked us, an article or post-Juve pod, please go through the different tactical formations following the subs. For Madrid, I assume, not Juve. From what I saw, it was a 4-2-3-1, interchangeable in three behind with Benz over the top, and then a change to some sort of 4-3-3 with a false nine. And now in the end, I don't know with what Lucas and Mayoral as forward with Asensio as center mid and Llorente as center back in a 4-4-2. So basically, I think that the question is what were the kind of tactical formations that Lopetegui was trying out in this game?
I mean, I think he's pretty much correct in that. Well, definitely the first half was a 4-3-3 for sure. It was a 4-3-3 in the first half because it was Benz up top, Bale on the right. Was it Vinicius who started? No, it was Isco.
We also had Ceballos, like the spearhead.
Right, yeah, it was Isco. Almost. Sorry, yeah. It was Isco on the left. It was Ceballos and Fede as the two interiors, and Kroos as the anchor in the three-man midfield as a defensive midfielder. So it was definitely a 4-3-3. And then in the second half, you had Asensio come on for Benzema. You had Vinicius come on for Isco. And I think it was Odegaard who came on for Bale, if I'm not wrong. So it was still a 4-3-3. And then after that, when, you know, Mayoral and Lucas came on, I think throughout the entire game, we were just seeing different players all in the same 4-3-3, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't have anything to add to this.
That's what I thought also. Yeah. Okay, Christian Gonzalez asked, I'd like to know how confident you, Keon, are of having Llorente be part of a starting 11 in a match where everyone else is a starter, just filling in for Casemiro. This is, of course, in an important La Liga match.
I feel fine. I feel more than comfortable with it.
I also feel comfortable.
I have no doubt in Llorente's ability, even in a big game. Like, I think he's fine. I think the way Lopetegui will use the midfield this year, I think will give a lot of confidence to both Llorente and Ceballos, where you have six midfielders for three positions. You have Llorente behind Casemiro, Kovacic behind Modric or Kroos, and Ceballos behind Modric or Kroos. And I think I would be more than confident in Llorente reading the game from that position and just distributing the ball quickly. I'd be fine with it.
And I know Christian's not asking me, but I'm going to say something.
Then anyway. don't give your opinion if he's not asking.
I just wanted to supplement with Keon.
Oh, okay. Then go ahead.
Because Zidane didn't necessarily use Llorente to his strengths. The way Zidane likes to use his defensive midfielders was quite unique to his system. Wasn't very involved in possession, you know, was kind of shoved out of the way a little bit, played higher up the pitch, in between the lines sometimes, and then used as this kind of roaming destroyer when the ball was lost. And that's not who Llorente is at all. The way Lopetegui plays is something that is a hell of a lot more suited to the kind of player that Llorente is. More of a deep lying playmaker, a lot more involved in distribution of the ball, you know, and a little more static with his positioning. Defense, you're going to see this season, is going to be a lot more about the collective and a lot more about structure than Casemiro or whoever's playing defensive midfielder single-handedly saving the entire team, you know, with these incredible defensive bursts. I mean, I'm sure we'll still see that at times because the structure won't always be perfect. It'll break down, and we're going to need our defensive midfielder to step up with these incredible interceptions and tackles. But it's going to be much more about structure and much more about positioning within that structure.
Yeah.
And I think Casemiro is still going to thrive in that defensive setup, but Llorente's strengths are now going to come to the fore, and he's going to look a lot better here.
He's built for it.
Yeah. Because that's kind of how he played with Alaves, not on the offensive end, but on the defensive end. That's why his numbers were so impressive and he looked so impressive, because he played in a defensive system that was much more about the collective, where it wasn't all on him, and it was his intelligent defensive positioning that allowed him to rack up those numbers. And I think we're going to see the same thing here with Lopetegui.
And this was also an Alaves team that really just barely had possession of the ball, and they relied a lot on the counterattacks. And Llorente, imagine a team that just doesn't have possession and gets pressed a lot because of the nature of how deep they played. He was in all kinds of positions where he was always pressed, and he would always feel comfortable and confident getting out of it with either a touch or a quick outlet. And like, he's the type of player who will just get the ball to point A to point B as quick as possible. And I think his press resistance really helps in the situation, especially if Lopetegui wants his anchor to play deeper and drop in behind and in between the center backs when needed. And one of his greatest assets to me is also being very good in starting counters. Like, he's never going to be the one who's going to provide a key pass, but he is going to be one who will distribute from the back as one of, and not to compare him in terms of I guess your greatness levels, but stylistically to me he's still very similar to Busquets in that he reads the game, and I think he can get to a point where the opposing teams will start to realize that they have to take him out of the game just to prevent any build up and to stifle Real Madrid's attacks. I think he has that potential.
I agree. I mean, I don't have anything else to add. This is a good question, I think, but I also think that finally he's going to be, coached by someone who understands what he can bring in a better way than I think Zidane did. He kept playing him out of position a little bit. So I'm hopeful. All right. And last guaranteed question we have here is Adrian Rios asks, what's up with Lopetegui? He deleted his Instagram and Twitter. I only find it strange because he was very active on social media, then all of a sudden he deleted it. Does it feel like Real Madrid is trying to be overly cautious with him?
Oh, it has nothing to do with Real Madrid, I'm sure. I think it has everything to Lopetegui realizing exactly what this fan base is like and I'm not going to deal with any of that shit and out the window.
I'm surprised he even kept it for that long.
Me too.
Yeah. Because all it's going to fucking take, I'm sure in preseason when we lost, he was already getting these comments. All it's going to take is like a loss in La Liga. And the last thing he needs is Marvin fucking messaging and being like, what the fuck are these tactics, man? The structure here was off. You need to do this, this, and this. I'm sure he's like, yeah, I don't need that.
That isn't even the craziest shit that he probably gets. Like,
oh, yeah, that's
useful. That's nice and useful.
Yeah, the go kill yourself type comments that we've seen on other players' posts are probably something he doesn't need to handle. And I think, honestly, if I was a player or a coach, I would delete my social media as well. I mean, I understand that some players need it because they become, huge marketing icons like Ronaldo, so that's not an option for them. But that's not the case.
You can make a lot of money on sponsored posts. Yeah, I would keep them, but I'd also not ever do it myself. I would literally never check it and hire someone to do it.
Yeah, but that's not the case with coaches, right? They're rarely ever marketing icons and stuff like that. They make their money from either writing books or mostly, overwhelmingly, from the salary they get from the club. So their social media is not nearly the same asset it is as it is for players. So he really has no reason to keep it other than interacting with people online, and that's not really much of a motivation when you're at a club where the fan base is so demanding and, frankly vicious at times. It's not a surprise at all to me to see him deleted.
All right, last two. I wanted to get your thoughts. First of all, we do, and the last one is just kind of housekeeping, but you guys both play FIFA, and so this is a question. Did you guys see the FIFA Raul icon card, and how excited are you to use it? Do you think the stats are accurate?
So I play FIFA. I generally just in my spare time, I just I essentially roast people on FIFA and just annihilate them. I've never played Ultimate Team. So I don't even know. I think the icon card has to do with the FIFA Ultimate Team. I'd never done it, but I was looking at his stats. I'll just read them off to you guys. 88 for pace, 92 for shooting, 82 for passing, 90 for dribbling, 47 for defending, 75 for physicality, and 92 overall. I think the pace is generous, but at the same time, I think when you're creating a FIFA player, if he's not fast, he's not going to be good. So I think it would be awkward to put slow Raul in the game. That's why, because then he just wouldn't be good. I don't know. I think everything else is kind of good defensively. Like, I'm not sure what defense really means in the context of FIFA, like what attributes specifically, but he was very intelligent off the ball in his pressing and stuff. So I don't have much to add. I don't even use.
What was his overall?
92.
92.
Yeah, I mean, I think he could probably be really good finisher in this game. He'd score a bunch of goals.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to add because I don't have a console beyond the Xbox 360. So the last FIFA game I could play was FIFA 17. So yeah, I don't play Ultimate Team either. So
yeah, I'll have to start now that I know this is an option.
Ultimate Team will fucking suck your life away, dude.
Okay, then I won't get into it. I played Fortnite for one night, and that was it. I just
I've given up on video games. Unfortunately, I wish I should. I should
no, it's fortunately. More. Thank God.
All right, last just piece of housekeeping, just in reference to Elian Zako's question about the fan stories. Like, I think everyone remembers that we did that giveaway of the Gareth Bale signed jersey. And we read some of our favorites. That was sort of what we figured that was sort of the end of that. Assuming that we get, you know, maybe we'll get another one of these giveaways again, we could do something like that. So, and we'll read more fan stories. And occasionally I think, you know, it might be cool just to, when we don't have as much things to say, we'll read some stories that we like, but yeah. For now, we're not going to just go in through and take an entire episode of the show to just read all of the submissions we got. Cause there were quite a few, but we really appreciate everyone's stories and it was really cool to read them. And that was a great show. And we got to
it was really fun. Yeah. No, all the stories were great. And so that episode we went in, we read, I think the best, not best, but it was, I think the highest ranked in terms of the most likes per post. We read like the most popular out loud and it brought back a ton of memories, like just to our own stories. And it was cool listening to your stories. It was a ton of fun.
It was great. Yeah.
We should do Patreon shoutouts.
Let's do it.
Patreon.com/managingmadrid is where you go to get different rewards and get access to more shows apart from the weekly Sunday episodes. And we have a lot of content coming up your way this season. I think at least 2, possibly 3 extra shows per week. We'll see. Shout out to these specific patrons who pledge $10 or more. And your reward is you get a shout out on the podcast. Nick DeStefane, Sergio Monleon, Tyler Dixon, Raul Gutierrez, Gary Kohut, Raghav Potluri, Bjorn Salvador, Dan Berthy, John Fernandez, Frederick Sundros, Selvin Adolfo, Chamale Perez, Anas Alazawi, Sheikh Atiri, Red Bat, Leon Stavronakis, Armin Gashi, Eric Rogers, Nick Ribeiro, Yahya Ibrahim, Said Mahad, Vicky Cohen, Magnus Lext, Jason Fitz, Anton Hackbrook, Solomon Ortiz, Jeanette, Jimmy Obeid, and Daniel Smith. Whew. Gets longer every week. I love it. You guys are amazing. Really great. Thank you so much. Rule.
Thank you so much. All right, until Wednesday then, Kian. And Om Ala Madrid.
Ala Madrid.
Ala Madrid.